I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. Autumn is supposed to be the time of the year when coastal residents can catch their breath after the hustle of the summer season. That's true for many people, but not for the folks who work at NASA's Wallops Flight Facility. This once rather obscure NASA outpost is now a key player in all sorts of space-related research and launches. Just last week, NASA sent a rocket 167 miles above the Earth in a launch to support a high-altitude science research. Unmanned planes will also take off from Wallops this fall to study hurricanes in the Atlantic, and the facility will also be sending up rockets to resupply the International Space Station. I swung by Wallops earlier this week to learn more about some of these projects and what they tell us about the future of NASA and the future of the U.S. role in space.
Hi, I'm Jay Pittman, and I'm the Chief of the Range and Mission Management Office here at Wallops Flight Facility.
So before we get into some of the big things that have been happening that are, you know, kind of on the horizon of what's going on at Wallops, let's talk about the two launches that took place last weekend.
Well, they're both very exciting and very successful. So the first mission was called RockSat-X. It's a mission that allows college university students to put together their own payloads and to learn about the end-to-end process that we have to go through every time we launch a rocket. So it's a big part of our outreach, but it's also a big part of our preparing the next generation of explorers to do what we do. So there were a total of, I think, four or five experiments on the mission. The mission is it goes up well over 100,000 feet, so it is in a space environment. And we recover the mission and bring it back, and they can look at the data from their experiments and take those back to the universities and learn what they did right and wrong with their experiments. But also, they can learn about how difficult it is in that challenging environment to get to space.
And these rockets that went up, they're often called research rockets. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, you're trying to find information many times about weather and our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about the second rocket on Saturday?
Well, the second rocket was really unique. It was a partnership between our program here, our Sun and Rocket program, and actually part of the Defense Department. What we were doing, and we would have done this regardless, we were researching the performance of a brand new rocket. So we were launching this as a test of the vehicle to see whether this new kind of rocket that we've put together can give us the kinds of performance to enable the science that we normally do. So it was a vehicle test. Well, it turns out on vehicle tests where you don't know if they're going to work, there's not much interest from scientists in flying on those kinds of things. But we did find a DOD program that had a fairly new technology. They wanted to see if it worked in flight, and they flew on that mission. So we were able to accomplish two goals: not only to demonstrate the performance of this new rocket, but also to allow a flight test for a new technology for the Defense Department.
Right. You know, there's some other exciting things that have just been announced in the past few weeks, one of which was this five-year, I believe, $50 million project. It's about essentially flying into the eye of hurricanes, mm-hmm. and gathering data, mm-hmm. All by unmanned aircraft, these, yep. Global Hawks. Tell me a little bit about those and just where that project is right now. I know the first year is kind of, you know, working out the kinks, 3 years of gathering data, and then the last year being, you know, assessing that data. Where is it right now?
Well, it's even better than what you described. Okay, so here's the problem. Humankind doesn't really understand why certain storms in the Atlantic turn into hurricanes, and why some do and why some don't. And so in order to understand that, it's important to be able to put something in those weather patterns as they roll off the coast of Africa and into the Atlantic, and to stay there and to have persistent observation in those storm patterns as they move across the Atlantic. The Global Hawk is an aircraft that gives us that capability. So what that mission does, it really is looking at the genesis of hurricanes so that we can understand which ones will turn into hurricanes and which ones don't. So the deployment of these large unmanned aircraft here gives us that capability for the first time at Wallops to put instruments and sensors into those storms and to follow them as they evolve into perhaps hurricanes and perhaps into nothing. So yeah. So that's it, there's a lot of excitement about that.
Sure. And I found it fascinating that, you know, the fact that you're flying these huge aircraft into a hurricane. Mm-hmm. But the way in which you're doing it, I know that, you know, it's not just being controlled here at Wallops. Mm-hmm. It also has something to do with California.
Yep.
Explain that a little bit, because I find that to be fascinating.
Sure. Well, these flights are very long, so, you know, 20 or more hours. So the way it works is we've got control centers here at Wallops, and those control centers are involved in the takeoff and landing. So a typical flight, control of the vehicle will be here at Wallops. The vehicle will go out onto our runways, take off, and they spiral up very high. These aircraft fly much higher than a normal passenger aircraft. So they spiral up and then head out, honestly, toward the African coast, so well out into the Atlantic. And after about 5 hours, we shift control to Dryden Flight Center out in California. And the flights out over the Atlantic and into the hurricane are actually, or into the storm activity, are controlled by them. That's usually about 10 hours or so. And then after that, the vehicle turns around and comes back to base. And so control is then passed back to pilots here at Wallops, and they bring it in for the landing. Yeah. And we cycle it back for the next day.
And I know that most of the science, or all of the science, is handled here. So all that data that is gathered is coming back here. So what are these aircraft, the Global Hawks, I guess, how are they gathering the data, and what kind of data are they sending back to you?
Particularly pressure. They're looking at the turbulence in the air, but they're also equipped with drop zones, so they can actually deploy, parachute dropped instruments down into the storm, so we can get a sounding of the weather all the way down. So it's quite a comprehensive data set that they're pulling back.
And certainly this year, as you know, maybe just compared to last year, the magnitude of hurricanes that we've seen have been a bit less than mm-hmm. last year. Mm-hmm. What data have you been able to gather this year so far in the infancy of this program based on the storms that we've, you know, read about and seen?
Well, right now, we really are in a data collection activity. I don't think that the scientists are ready to make a conclusion yet. I think right now what we've done is we've given them, for the first time, we've given them the ability to take, as I said, storms rolling off the African continent, some of which turn into hurricanes and some of which don't, and we're able to give them data about those. And our expectation and hope is that they'll be able to, you know, look at that information and start to make some sense that will enable, you know, enable us to make better projections about the dangers that are posed to the population of the United States much further in advance.
Yeah. I know you guys are working with the state of Virginia and the commercial space flight company Orbital Sciences Corporation on a plan to launch, you know, 10 or so flights from this facility, including 8 resupply missions to the International Space Station. Talk about that project and what people should be watching for in the future with those things.
Well, it's about the biggest thing that's happened here in quite a while, as you can imagine. And it may be certainly the largest rocket that we will ever have launched. There has been tremendous progress by Orbital and by Mars and by NASA in preparing for the missions that are coming up. But what we'll get into is a series of motor tests. So we'll do tests of that engine. We'll test out the performance of the now built launch pad and a fueling facility that's associated with it. There'll be a major engine test coming up, where the vehicle will be bolted down to the pad, and then we'll fire the rocket and to test its performance, in the flight configuration. And then a little while after that, we'll roll out and do the first test flight. That will prove out the capability of the vehicle literally to achieve orbit. After that will be a mission to demonstrate not only the second flight of the rocket, but also the ability of its payload, which is called the Cygnus. That, too, is an orbital spacecraft. That Cygnus will autonomously dock with the space station, and that will a successful demonstration there will show that Orbital has the capability to resupply station, and the next flight up will take equipment up to the space station where we need it.
It seems that in this kind of new space age of sorts that there's going to be much more of a partnering between private companies and, you know, the government and NASA. Mm-hmm. Tell me how those roles are kind of split up in this case, and is this kind of project really the future of how this sort of space exploration is going to be done?
My sense is, to get to your last question first, that it is. I think partnering is in NASA's future. I think that's not only the direction from our senior leadership, But it's I think it's what the public wants from us. I think NASA's job is to do those things that only NASA can do. And it's clear that there are commercial companies that are now in the business of delivering creating rockets that can deliver payloads to low Earth orbit. So I think that's the right thing. So in the partnership that we have here, you've got Virginia that has created some infrastructure on the ground that enables a rocket to be erected onto a launch pad. You've got NASA in its role as the provider of a launch range, which ensures public safety and ensures safe passage for the vehicle from ground to orbit. And you've got Orbital creating a FedEx delivery from Earth to orbit. So yeah. It's that same thing, I think.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm your host, Brian Russo, and we're speaking with Jay Pittman. He's the chief of the range and missions operations here at NASA's Wallops Flight Facility in Wallops Island, Virginia. Jay, I was reading about, and I know it's not something that's going to be launched here, but I was reading about these satellites that are going to be put up into orbit in the very near future. And they're extremely small, something like the size of a coffee cup. Tell me about those.
Everybody's excited about these. Everybody in NASA, I think there's commercial interest in them as well. But anybody that's been watching technology for any amount of time, one of the key features of it has been getting smaller. Mm-hmm. And so it really is true that we're putting up much smaller satellites. And the ones you're talking about are called CubeSats. They're literally about a 10-centimeter cube. And so if you put maybe two or three of these together, they would only be about the size of a loaf of bread. The point is that miniaturization and advances in technology and communications technology and power management and batteries, all of those have come together to let us squeeze a lot more capability into a much smaller space. That translates into a huge improvement in terms of what we can do in space, because the big challenge in space is getting there. That is a huge thing.
And it's also the cost, too.
It is a huge cost. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but it's a lot of money to get a pound to space. So there are a lot of entities working to try to figure out what we can do with this new form factor. I mean, I think, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but there are even models where the computer that forms the basis of this satellite really can be something the size, or even a cell phone. A cell phone running the Android operating system would be easy to do.
Wow. Just going back to the cost for a minute, I think I read something that these little satellites will cost something like $50,000 to launch one of these things, whereas some of the larger ones can run hundreds of millions of dollars. With that being said, and in a time when, we're always trying to find a new way to do things better at less of a cost, are these little satellites the future of what's going to be going up into space?
Well, that's a big debate right now. I think it's probably true that for the foreseeable future, there will be a job for the big satellites. I don't think there's any question. There's certain things. I mean, certainly if you need a big aperture, if you need to collect a lot of light, then you probably need a big satellite. But what we're finding is that there is a lot of science. There's a lot of capability that we can put up at that much smaller scale. And there are advanced concepts that involve these small satellites working together just like a swarm would be. So you can imagine that they would distribute their functionality across, 10s or 20s, or you can imagine even hundreds of these things circling and doing the job of a larger satellite because of our ability to put advanced processing on board these systems.
I know another big debate that's been going on here at Wallops is this idea of whether or not to, welcome Navy flights. I know there's been conversation, there's a public meeting that's scheduled, I think, for later this week, about the idea or this plan that the Navy might be able to use Wallops to conduct up to 20,000 passes annually. What's been, I guess, the chatter in the community about whether or not the local community wants that many, jet passings?
That's a good question. Well, the first thing I do want to poke a little bit is that there are no jets involved. So that's important. We were requested a few years back to consider having jets involved in that same thing. But quite honestly, from a NASA perspective, we believe we have the goodwill of the local community, and we're eager to maintain that. So we've been asked to consider allowing training activities for carrier landings, for pilots, to do carrier landings here in propeller-driven planes. These planes, in fact, actually they're out flying today. So mm-hmm. so it is routine for us to have these planes here. We don't believe that this activity will result in any significant change in the overall interference with the local population. Right. That said, I think there's been a lot of maybe fear and a little bit of misinformation out about this.
You know, now that this we're in kind of this new space age, so to speak, and it's been well documented that Wallops is a very big part of that new direction of where NASA's going. So, you know, when thinking about the impact mm-hmm. from an economic standpoint or just from a community standpoint that Wallops has, mm-hmm. do you anticipate that growing more as Wallops becomes more in the spotlight of what's going on with NASA?
I do. I think it will grow here locally. And I want to add one other aspect as I talk about the areas where we help the community maybe grow. Our goal is to be an inspiration to the kids in the local community, but also everywhere. And there's nothing like activity. There's nothing like a plane that can fly from here to Africa, you know, and take 20 hours in the air. There's nothing like a gigantic rocket launching, or you know, to show college kids that they too can create a payload and launch it on a rocket. That inspires people, and that's important to us. So I think our goal is to not only be a benefit to the community in terms of the economics of it, but honestly, if I can be so bold, maybe to be an inspiration to the community as well, to let them know all some of the great stuff that we're doing, that they're a part. This community is part of the space age.
And, you know, the work that you guys do here just blows my mind every time I come down here. You know, but it leads me to wonder, and every time I leave here, I start thinking about that education aspect and connecting with young kids. And I have young kids, and they look at the stars and are fascinated, I'm sure, as both you and I did. But, you know, we live in an age where the kids coming up maybe don't remember that moment of putting a man on the moon or some of the, you know, shuttle launches. I guess what's the strategy to engage these kids with maybe something that's not quite as sexy as putting a man on the moon when it's really more hard data gathering and science?
Not everybody is excited by an airplane. Not everybody's excited by a rocket. Not everybody's excited by a balloon that can circumnavigate the globe. We do all that stuff here. But our hope is that by being open and engaging kids at every chance we get, that we can inspire somebody somehow and make them know that they can be a part of that future that we see.
Yeah. With all the stuff we've talked about today, you know, I assume and gather that this must be a very exciting time to work at Wallops.
There is an excitement. There is a real sense that we're part of the future of not only Goddard and NASA, but we're part of the future of where the nation is going.
We've been speaking with Jay Pittman. He's the chief of the range and mission operations here at NASA's Wallops Flight Facility. Jay, always nice to see you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Hope to see you again.
To learn more, click to our website, wamucoast.org. You're listening to Coastal Connection here on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. I'm Brian Marcel.